You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
To mark the one-year anniversary of Israel's bloody 22-day assault on Gaza, an international coalition to end the illegal siege of Gaza is planning to dispatch contingents from around the world to Gaza. On January 1st, 2010, they will march alongside the people of Gaza in a nonviolent demonstration to breach the illegal blockade. The march is inspired by decades of nonviolent Palestinian resistance, from the mass popular uprising of the First Intifada to the West Bank villagers currently resisting the land grab of Israel's annexationist wall. It draws inspiration from the international volunteers who have stood by Palestinian farmers harvesting their crops, from the crews on the vessels who have challenged the Gaza blockade by sea, and from the drivers of the convoys who have delivered humanitarian aid to Gaza. In their declaration, they say, "We are not afraid. We won't turn back. We won't let Gaza die. We conceive this march as yet another link in the chain of nonviolent resistance to Israel's flagrant disregard of international law." And they appeal for people to join them. For more information, you can Google GazaFreedomMarch.org on the Code Pink website, or go to the Red Eye website for the link, cooperadio.org/redeye. But right now, Gaza remains under siege, a siege driven by Israel, but one in which the Egyptian government also is complicit. Very recently, journalist John Elmer, who lives in Vancouver but reports often from Palestine and Lebanon, tried to cross from Egypt into Gaza. Blocked from entry, he gave an interview to the program Flashpoints on the Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley. With John Elmer's permission, we now rebroadcast his report. John begins by describing the scene at the Egypt-Gaza border.
I'm in the North Sinai Desert, just south of the Gaza Strip, attempting to cross into Gaza to report and experiencing many of the obstacles that you described in your lead there. Egypt, although publicly says that it's in support of the Palestinians and that it would never blockade its brothers, as Mubarak has said, as you noted, has played a crucial role in the blockade. The border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt is really the Palestinians' only exit point, considering that Israel controls the sea, controls the airspace, and of course, Gaza being a ghetto is completely an enclave within the Israeli state, so there's no way of passing through any border besides with Egypt into the Palestinian territory. So in fact, in many ways, Egypt's blockade of the Gaza border, which happens, of course, in conjunction with the Israelis, is as devastating as the Israeli side. And it's important to note, of course, that the number one recipient of American aid is Israel, but attached to that, the number two recipient, give or take, is Egypt, and that goes back to the Camp David Accords, and effectively it's aid for the dictatorship of Mubarak, who regularly wins elections now. He won his sixth election in 2006 with really impressive numbers, 99% of the vote, and has had a state of emergency in place, parliamentary approved state of emergency in place since 1981. Effectively, that state of emergency is against the main grassroots opposition in Egypt, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, the umbrella political movement that gave birth to Hamas in the Palestinian territory. So, the blockade from the Egyptian side is less discussed and is less openly talked about, largely because we don't get the savory quotes that the Israelis give us about the reasons for the blockade, but has been devastating for the Palestinians. And I'm in Al-Arish right now, which is the sort of largest city in the North Sinai, about 45 kilometers south of Gaza. And here in Arish, you have a situation where aid that cannot get into Gaza is left to rot in the main football stadium, the airport, at the seaport, The blockade of humanitarian transfers from the Gaza Strip, of course, are visible on the streets all over Arish and all over the North Sinai, as Palestinians are able for various reasons to leave the Gaza Strip, but then not return, leave the Gaza Strip in many cases for necessary health treatments that are not available in the Gaza Strip. And so, the border with Rafah, to quote Israeli numbers, previous to the Intifada in 2000, you had more than 1,000 Palestinians crossing each day into Egypt. Now, the blockade that Israel has imposed, although we often link it to the election of Hamas or more recently to the Hamas takeover in Gaza, of course predates that significantly. And we've seen those numbers of people crossing the borders down to, according to Gisha, which is an Israeli legal human rights group, down to about 3% of what it was historically. And there's no official policy in place to oversee the Egyptian side of the blockade. So at least on the Israeli side, we know it's total. But on the Egyptian side, it's not spoken of and it's not acknowledged. And therefore, nobody understands when they can cross and when they cannot. And you get these amazing situations that I've witnessed here along the border in my the blockade has affected me as well as an internationally accredited journalist. I'm having difficulty getting in across the border. Hopefully that will change. But as it stands, I've gone a number of times to the border with what I thought was coordination to cross and found myself amongst the Palestinians who have been also blocked from going to the border and met, really harrowing stories of people that are on the borders who, for example, one case of a man that I met who was, these are uncounted casualties of Israel's blockade and of Israel's war on Gaza in December and January. He was a diabetic. He is a diabetic, and insulin supplies were part of the blockade and weren't allowed into Gaza in sufficient numbers during the war. And so he lost his leg, as many and many others did, losing limbs to gangrene because of the lack of insulin. And so he's on the border with his prosthetic leg that he got in Egypt. He was granted permission to leave the Gaza Strip, but now can't get back home again, and literally sleeps night after night out in the desert underneath an awning of an empty shop right on the border, living on the largesse of, ironically and absurdly, the Egyptian border guards that are under orders not to allow people back in are giving him, whatever is left of their lunch and whatnot, and that's what he's surviving on. You have 85% of or more people in Gaza dependent on food aid. So there's not a lot of what we would call savings or credit. And so when people are leaving to go to a place like Cairo, which is a six-hour journey away, they don't have the kind of resources to then stay in a hotel or whatnot until the border can be cleared up, the kind of access and resources that I as a journalist have. Talking to you from my hotel in Arish, he's still sleeping on the border again tonight for the second straight week, waiting for his access to cross back home again, to get back home again. So it's not, something that's affecting international businessmen who want to go to Saudi Arabia to do an oil deal or whatnot. You're talking about the real salt of the earth. People are affected in the most fundamental ways. And when I first met him, his phone was ringing and his family was calling, for the fifth time that day and for the 100th time in the last 2 weeks to find out what he knows and when he's coming home. And the only answer he can ever give is, I don't know, maybe tomorrow. And that's the condition. That's just one story, but I could tell you the story of the literally dozens. It's not known exact numbers because people blend back into the Egyptian landscape to wait. If they do have resources, are renting apartments or staying with family. Many Palestinians here in Arish are in overcrowded apartments, trying to share rent, having their rent paid by Palestinian authorities if they can, while they wait for coordination that comes maybe once a month if they're lucky. So, you know, this is a really untold element of the blockade on Gaza and how it affects, you know, how the Egyptian regime itself has affected that that part of the blockade.
We're listening to John Elmer. He's speaking from the Egypt-Gaza border. And in the second part of his interview, he describes what happens to the humanitarian aid that is blocked from entry into Gaza.
Well, in many cases through Egypt, what you have is you have other Arab neighbors or North African neighbors sending aid outside of these international organizations. And so, you know, because of what is not allowed in is the same on the Egyptian side as it is for the Israelis. And so when people, for example, you know, Libyan shipments or, you know, of course the war in Gaza in December and January created a situation where average people in countries all over the world, but of course particularly in this region, were giving and giving to try to help the circumstance. And so you had people sending these aid shipments, which are, if you know, if they have one thing on the banned list, and I don't know how much time we have to go into what's on the banned list, but it's so comprehensive that an entire truck shipment can be turned back because it has something like paper in it, or chocolate in it, or almonds in it. Something like this can turn back an entire shipment. And so this is the reality of the situation, and no one really knows what to do here in Arish or elsewhere about what to do with the aid, because as we say, it just simply rots. In some cases, it's being given to, you know, impoverished people here in Arish, which is itself a very poor area. But if we can sort of get into some of the banned items on the Israeli list, which is of course the same as the Egyptian list, it would be shocking to listeners. You know, electronic, anything electronic, any appliances, refrigerators, washing machines, any kind of spare parts, car parts, fabrics, threads. Here I'm reading from the Office of the Coordination for Government Activities in the Territories. This is an official Israeli list of banned items. You know, includes light bulbs, candles, matches, books, musical instruments, crayons, clothing, shoes, mattresses, sheets, blankets, cutlery, crockery, cups, glasses. You know, and these kind of things, if any of these items, sesame seeds, chocolate, nuts, appear in any of these products or any of these shipments, then they're banned. And this is one of the things that the Viva Palestina George Galloway convoy is experiencing, in that they're attempting to bring in things that are not banned on the list, so as to bring anything at all. If you mix in your medical supplies with your almonds, they're not going to get in and, you know, get in. And you get ridiculous situations where shampoo is allowed but conditioner is not. And so you have an entire shipment of, you know, two-in-one shampoo that gets turned back because it has conditioner mixed in. And the level of detail, the meticulous level of detail that the Israeli government coordinating office has on these products is really shocking. This is not an accidental blockade or some sort of broad-based sanctions. You have it literally down to the caloric intake for each individual in the Gaza Strip divided by what is called, you know, humanitarian crisis levels. And this links back to what the key Israeli advisor, you know, if I could call him the Karl Rove to Sharon and Olmert and Tzipi Livni, Dov Weisglass, he called it, when Hamas was elected, he called it the diet, that the people of Gaza were going to be put on a diet. You know, they were going to be put to the edge of starvation, but not starved to death. That was the goal, stated publicly, openly, front page of the New York Times, Haaretz kind of stuff. And so the mantra of the Israeli officials is, if I can quote it, no prosperity, no development, but no humanitarian crisis. So it's to keep people right on the edge of starvation. And so these aid shipments that come from various places throughout the world need to conform extremely strictly to these guidelines. And if they don't, then they don't pass. And so that's really what's led to this situation, is that the meticulous detail of which the blockade has been administered makes it so that it's almost impossible. It really is almost impossible, as I'm sure George Galloway will tell you in the coming days, it's virtually impossible to get into the Gaza Strip with any kind of humanitarian aid. I mean, you don't need George Galloway. You can get the World Food Program or the United Nations to, or the International Committee of the Red Cross to tell you the exact same thing. And this is well known. I mean, it's not, these are not secret documents that are being dredged up here. This is, you know, what I'm quoting from is from government sources. It's from openly in the newspaper, and it's well known within the Gaza Strip. I mean, since the war the assault on Gaza in December and January, there has been literally not 1 ounce of concrete allowed into the Gaza Strip to rebuild. I mean, you cited that police station. They're still moving out the rubble, but they're not moving any kind of rebuilding products back in. No glass, no wood, no beams. None of the fundamental, no metal reinforcements for, to build with concrete at all. You know, the United Nations actually reconstituted, absurdly enough, reconstituted the demolished section of the wall when Hamas blew up the wall in the winter of 2008 and allowed people out of Gaza for the first time sometimes in 15 years. The United Nations actually used that concrete section of the wall because Israel rebuilt the wall, Egypt rebuilt the wall on Israel's request just a few meters away from where Hamas blew it up. The United Nations took that concrete, reground it up, and made it into a water filtration plant because there's been no rebuilding in an area that was devastated as totally as, as Flashpoint listeners, I'm sure, are well aware of the totality of the destruction in the Gaza Strip during that attack. Nothing has been rebuilt. You know, you have situations where people are building with mud. And so it's just the question is what you want to look at to find how the blockade has affected people. And so I happen to be in Arish, and so I go and look at the rotting food. But if you were in southern Israel around Sedero, you'd go up and you'd probably meet with the Israeli farmers who themselves are upset about the blockade because it's meant that their foodstuffs can't be sold to the captive market in Gaza. And remember, you have a million and a half people in Gaza. You have three Tel Avivs worth of people that are a captive market for Israeli products, and that's no small thing for Israeli farmers. So, if you want to ask health professionals the impact, you get one set of stories. If you want to ask machinery people who work in the machinery and sections of the economy, agriculture. And so I'm just in a situation where I can see the rotting food, but if I were, in a different place, I would explain a different element of the siege, which is total, and that's what's important to understand. This is not a defense against rocket fire or, a way to make it so that, one prisoner of war, Israeli prisoner of war, is handed back. You have an absolute war on a population that takes place in their ability to eat, to live day by day. And in fact, like I said about the humanitarian element, the health element, you have people that lose their limbs unnecessarily simply because they can't get the basic medications that the rest of the world takes for granted, something like insulin, And so it's just which area you decide to, focus your lens on to see the totality of the blockade.
We're listening to journalist John Elmer speaking from the Egypt-Gaza border, and in the final part of the interview, he compares his previous visits to Gaza with what he expects to find this time.
Well, I mean, I've reported a couple times for Flashpoints from Gaza over the last 5 or 8 years, and I am curious to see a situation where, in 2003, I was, my interviews, my photographs, my discussions with people were talking about how 2003 was the worst year people had ever seen. Then 2005, the siege really cracked down after the disengagement, and people said, we've never seen a worse day. And then I was there in 2006, 2007, when the American and Canadian-backed attempt to overthrow the Hamas government militarily, which is one of the reasons why this humanitarian catastrophe has been inflicted, is because the military attempt to overthrow Hamas failed. I was there. People said this is, the worst day we've ever seen, since the catastrophe in 1948. We've never seen anything like this. This Gaza Strip is a refugee population. It's effectively, it's a ghetto, it's an open-air prison, these kind of phrases, but it's effectively a refugee camp. And what you have is Palestinian farmers who lived on fulsome farms in what is now Israel and were driven into these squalid refugee camps where they live, with population densities that rival Manhattan. In what are refugee camps where people are, 88% dependent on food aid. So from that main narrative is being now added this really unprecedented war attack on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza, openly on the civilian infrastructure in Gaza. I mean, you mentioned the police station. It wasn't Hamas militants. It wasn't Hamas militant cells that were the attacks that bore the brunt of the attack of Israel's assault in December and January. It was civilian police officers that the Americans and Canadians are funding in the West Bank as a key strategy to quote to make the two-state solution possible. In Gaza, it was those civilian police officers that bore the brunt of the attack. The first bombs dropped midday, midweek, at a graduation ceremony for civilian police officers. These are traffic cops. I mean, guys that stood out in the middle of the road and made people in a land without stoplights, as people are familiar with the region know all too well. Traffic officers. That was the target of Israel's first significant statement. Their shock and awe statement was the target of this civilian infrastructure. So although every time I've returned to this region, the situation has gotten worse, it's hard for me to imagine what I'm going to face after. In 2003 when I went there, I was shocked at the level of destruction in 2003. And that seems like a glory day ago for the way people are living today.
You've been listening to an interview with reporter and photojournalist John Elmer. He specializes in reporting from the Middle East, and his articles are available on the Interpress Service website, ipsnews.net, or you can find the link via the Red Eye website, coopradio.org/redeye. John has been interviewed on Red Eye several times, and he also regularly reports from the Middle East to the program Flashpoint, which broadcasts on KPFA radio station in Berkeley, California. We thank John for permission to rebroadcast this interview originally heard on Flashpoints.